You snowboard, you said? Yeah, no, I do not do that either. I don't understand why people want to go up and down hills all day. I don't understand that. Up and then down, and up and then down. Okay. Oh, crap. Sorry. Good catch. Apologize. Oh yeah, no. It was brought my attention that you have a test next week, which I will push out the week later, because in terms of material, the amount of material on that just doesn't make any sense. So I'll have a look at the schedule, see where we get today, and then I'll make an executive decision as to when we'll have that, as far as that goes. Okay. All right. So as usual, just like we did with the upper limb, we'll start with the bones first. We start proximally, work distally. So bones first, then joints, then muscles, and then work accordingly. I do jump down a little bit because obviously many muscles that we find in the pelvic bone do associate with the femur, so it'll all work out in the end. I am thinking that we will, pretty strongly thinking, our final will actually probably be in week 13, not week 14. It'll be the week prior to your OPs. So I think we'll be fine. I do. Okay. And as I said last week, if those who maybe they weren't here. So your final exam will only be on the lower limb, not comprehensive to the upper and lower limb. Right, we've already kind of covered it, so. Okay. So, the pelvis. As you've probably all sort of gotten from your labs, I talked about, nutation, counter-nutation, that kind of stuff. You see that the pelvis has an important role in everything. I always think of the association of the pelvis to the sacrum, with the sacrum being the foundation of the spine and how the spine sits. And because the sacrum and the pelvis have such a an intimate joint association, you can't do one without the other. If I ever had patients come to me with low back dysfunction, I always work from the knees up. Always have, because of how all these things interact. If you remember last semester how I somewhat talked about some of the ligaments between the sacrum and pelvis, there's a lot of strong ligaments there. So think of the sacrum as I said, the table or foundation of which the spine sits on, and then we have the pelvis intimately with that. So anything that causes the pelvis to tilt or turn, nutate or counter-nutate, then everything else after that just gets wonky, right? So it's something I want you to think about when we're doing this, is that you can't, and quite often when I worked on lumbar problems with people with low back pain, the problems within the gluteal muscles and so forth would just be horrendous. And I'd get in there and they didn't even know they had problems within those structures. So obviously it's a brim that things sit in the way it is. When we look at the pelvis, we're going to talk a little bit about its orientation. Although we call it a brim or a bowl, it doesn't sit like a bowl. It actually sits relatively anterior, and we'll get into that as well. So it is found inferior posterior to the abdomen, and as I said, it is the transition between the trunk and the lower limbs. And if you remember what we talked again about last semester, the whole setup, the way it works is the weight of the upper body on the lumbar spine and sacrum gets dissipated through that association of sacrum and pelvis and into the femurs and legs. So when our posture is appropriate when we sit or when we stand, we are in fact actually taking a lot of stress off the lumbar spine and dissipating it through this lumbopelvic association. The bony pelvis is the basin-shaped set of bones that enclose the urinary bladder, the distal GI structures, and the internal sexual organs. So it's, fairly well down there. The abdominal pelvic cavity extends superiorly to the thoracic cage and inferiorly to the interior of the bony pelvis. So when we look here, we can see the sort of this bowl-like structure, and we're talking about, so in this case it's a female, We can see uterus here, fallopian tubes, and so forth. We can see certain parts of, again, the large and small intestine and these lower sexual organs sitting within that bony pelvis. Now, the pelvis is enclosed by bony, ligamentous, and muscular wall. And for the first time last year, I've now started to include pelvic floor structures, something that we in massage didn't do in the past. But if anybody's had the experience or know of it through friends, there's a lot of association and work of therapy work for females in pelvic floor structures, right? My daughter, for example, was urine incontinent after her second child, and you know, we used to do Kegel exercises, and now she went for pelvic floor work and completely got rid of the incontinence just by working in there. Now we can't do that. We're not regulated to do that because that kind of work is done internally, for example, right? And they do pelvic floor work in males as well. Not sure how that works, but and you actually see it. I think on CTV there's these commercials now where you sit on this device. You sit on it and it vibrates or does something and it's supposed to strengthen the pelvic floor. I'm not particularly sure how that works, but okay. It is continuous of the abdominal cavity and is angulated posteriorly from it. The superior boundary is called the pelvic inlet and the inferior boundary is the pelvic outlet. What comes out of the pelvic outlet? In ladies, babies, okay? So the top is the inlet and the bottom is the outlet. You can see there is differences within the configuration when we look at males and females. Believe it or not, this is known as an android shape and this is known as a gynoid shape anatomically. And of course, it's all based upon the requirement for birthing of children, right? So we need that greater on the top, of course, is our inlets and on the bottom is our outlets. And you can see the distinct difference there, which allows for this. So, the bones that make up the pelvis are very powerful. I'm afraid I only have one, but we can work with that. It's all right. Does anybody have full skeletons at home?
No.
Kind of put it, yeah. Okay. Now, its functions, as I said, is weight transfer. So it, again, takes the weight of that upper body and transfers it out into the lower limbs. It does protect, and it is the attachment for large, powerful muscles. Now, we need to think of what happened evolutionarily. If we believe that we came from animals, most animals are quadrupeds, right? So they dissipate or they carry their weight through four limbs. So therefore, the pelvis is, although it's large, it's a bit different. When the decision was made, if it was a decision, however you believe, to stand on two legs, we had to make modifications to this pelvic region in order to hold us up. So therefore, when we look at the muscles of the lower leg or lower limb of the upper leg, big, 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 huge muscles, and they're there on purpose to keep us held up appropriately so that we are able to stand on two legs. So we have a very large mass of bone that provides huge surface area for muscular attachment to it. The bony pelvis is by four bones. There are two hip bones, one on each side, the sacrum in the middle, and the coccyx as well, which plays a role because of muscle attachments and ligaments and so forth. So they all make up this bony pelvis. And, you know, usually you have one in your kit. So we're only looking at one here. I do have a nice sacrum. It doesn't, it does kind of fit here to some degree. So we've got one half here in terms of this association that we can see here with this pelvis on the lateral aspect with the sacrum. Of course, we'd have one on the other side and we could see the coccyx down here on the bottom. We've already done the sacrum and coccyx last semester. And what we'll be looking at is the two hip bones, these ones here. Although I will be discussing the ligaments that we haven't gotten to yet between the pelvic bone and the sacrum. Now the pelvic bone actually has an anatomical name. It's either known as the os coxa or the inanimate bone. So you'll see that quite often in the literature that this is the os coxa or the coxa. You'll hear that as terms as well. There are three parts to this bone. So you can see them in the color here and they're named in these three separate parts, and that has to do with development inside mom. So the way that they set up, and we have a calcification or ossification of this bone in development, it's from three ossification centers. Superiorly, the very large wing is the ilium. The part that you're all sitting on right now is the ischium. And then the pubic makes up that pubic area anteriorly. So three parts, ilium, ischium, and pubic. Okay? Made up of all three of those areas. So, consists of three parts, the ilium, the pubis, and the ischium. The ilium represents the superior one-third. Okay, the superior part. The pubis represents the inferior one-third. And the ischium represents the posterior inferior one-third. Kind of makes sense? Yeah? Okay. Now, we can see here, there's a big concavity here. All three of these bones make up parts of this concavity, which is known as the acetabulum. And what's the acetabulum for? The head of the femur to form the hip joint. Okay? So all three parts of these bones make up parts of the acetabulum. The fusion of these bones begins to occur at 15 to 17 years as it can be completed by year 23, all cartilage replaced by bone. So you young folks in here still have a bit of cartilage in your pelvis if you're less than 23. I think there are a couple of you in here, yeah? There's a couple of students in here under the age of 23? Yeah. So you still have some cartilage in your pelvis and completely finishes by the time you're old like me. So you can see, again, with the drawings here, when we're looking at the acetabulum, we can see that the ilium represents this part of the acetabulum, the ischium this part, and the pubis this part here, all coming together. So the ilium, this upper part, also known as the wing, and it makes sense, right? When you look at it, it kind of looks like a wing. Okay? The superior portion of the inanimate bone, it's called the ala or the wing, and it is the flare of the hip, and you've all palpated even starting last semester, right? The height of it, this is called the iliac crest and so forth, right? So even though you didn't know the structure, it's probably how you started palpating initially. It's a very easy bone to find on everybody, and you kind of work from there. It is also, I think I told you about this before, a book that I used way back when for our assessments course. He talked about setups. I think I talked about this last semester. So, for example, if you're doing shoulder palpations, you always start with your hand on the acromion, right? If you're doing low thorax to upper leg, the best place to always start is iliac crest, and then you can work accordingly. You can come anteriorly to the ASIS. You can come posteriorly to the PSIS. You can come across the L4 and so on and so forth. So it's a nice place to start. Just literally putting your hands on either of those iliac crests, and you can move all over the place however you want to for palpations. By the way, the semester ones yesterday were like, last night they were like, how do you learn palpations? We can't palpate. And I'm like, practice. Sound familiar?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So yeah, just this is a nice place to start. It forms the superior two-thirds of the hip bone, and it makes up two-fifths of the acetabulum. Okay, so it's that superior part and about two-fifths of the acetabulum. We can see here with the lines drawn in, you can see how the ilium makes up a good majority, a large portion, of the acetabulum we can see here, and again, that superior part. On the ilium, what do we find? The first thing is the iliac crest, which, of course, all of you have palpated at this point. It's the highest point of the pelvis, and it bounds the internal and external lips of the ilium margin. So when we look at it, and we can see the iliac crest here, you can see that there's a bit of wideness to this apical part of it, and then it narrows in and behind. So this is why we call it the lips. So you can, when we say here we've got the internal and external lips of the margin, you can drop in a little bit here. You can drop in a little bit here as well. Obviously not very far, but you are able to work in between the two of them. It is easily palpated when we were able to do it. And again, any shape, size, it's easy to palpate. Now we have the iliac tubercle, and it is found just posterior to the anterior superior iliac spine. And this is the widest and sometimes the highest part of the pelvis. So you can see here, when we're talking about the tubercle, it's this big thick area here, right? So the anterior superior iliac spine is here. Then we have the iliac crest, but the iliac tubercle is this big thick part that lies just behind the anterior superior iliac, right? Okay, so that is the iliac tubercle. Now, the iliac crest extends anteriorly to form the anterior superior iliac spine, which you've probably already all palpated as well, which is the site for a muscle called sartorius. So sartorius attaches onto that ASIS, which I'm sure you all call it now, right? Use that term all the time now. So this is a detachment, a proximal attachment site for a muscle called sartorius. We also find something called the inguinal ligament. So there's a very large ligament that runs from this point down to the pubis. So we'll be talking about that later, but think of a ligament that runs sort of between my two fingers from here to here. This would be the inguinal ligament, okay? This area down in between here, you know, you think about where it is on my pelvis, this is kind of the inguinal area, right? We'll talk about inguinal hernias here. There's all sorts of things within this area. Inferior to the ASIS is the anterior inferior iliac spine. Is that palpable? No. Inferior? Yeah. Think of where that is anatomically. Are you sure? Yeah, so I'd be curious because I've always taught that it's not palpable, but you can palpate the quad, right? So we have rectus femoris that attaches there, and doing resisted hip flexion, you will feel the muscle, but I don't think you can palpate this. You have to understand the pelvis orientation isn't like this. It's like this, okay? So the pelvis doesn't sit like this in the body. It sits like this in the body, okay? It's open to the front. So therefore, if you think of your soft tissues and skin, yes, you can see how easily this is to palpate. I don't know how you get back there. AIIS. Interesting. Oh, it'd be hip flexion. Yeah, it'd be resistant hip flexion. I'll talk to Michelle because I never thought it was palpable.
You'll be surprised.
Okay. Just, I'll talk to her. Don't you guys say anything. Interesting. Okay. All right. So we've got the anterior superior. We've got the ASIS, right, which is for sartorius. And we have the AIIS, which is for rectus femoris, which is one of the quads in the quadricep group, okay? ASIS is easy to palpate, and the AIIS is difficult to palpate. So I would suggest, like, if that quadricep, if that rectus muscle is tight or lengthened, I would say that you probably can't palpate this. You would have to start with that. You'd have to shorten that muscle, make it nice and soft to get down through. Did you talk about that at all? Did that come up? Yeah. Right, you have to be in deflection, get it to soften up, and then you got to dig in, right? It's the same as psoas. Have you guys palpated psoas yet? Was that fun? Did you still do the wavy thing? I was always trained that when you do psoas, you wave, and what you're doing is you're moving the intestinal tract out of the way as you go down, because you are passing through the large colon and parts of the small intestine, right? But if you do the wave thing, you actually do move. And some of you may have noticed, you know, maybe there was some firmness in there, which is likely fecal matter in the large colon when you're working your way through as well. You guys have done abdominal massage, right? Not yet? Oh, that's a fun one. You make sure there's a direct pathway to the bathroom, because when you do abdominal massage, everybody's got to go to the bathroom. At least I always did. I was like, get me out of here, I've had enough. Right. Yeah, you actually learn in abdominal size, you actually do move fecal matter along. Yeah, you actually feel fecal matter in the intestine. So you can see here, here is our iliac crest here with the tubercle right here on the top. We do have the two lips, internal, external. We're looking at the lateral aspects of the ileum here. Here is your anterior superior iliac spine and your anterior inferior iliac spine. We can see here is sartorius, a very thin muscle that's coming off of the ASIS, and we can see rectus femoris here coming off the inferior iliac spine as part of the quadriceps group. Now the crest posteriorly, that iliac crest goes posteriorly to form or to the posterior superior iliac spine. And the PSIS is the right and left skin dimple found on the posterior sacral area. These dimples represent a horizontal line through S2. Okay, S2. And really what these represent, these two PSISs, represent the sacroiliac joint.
Are they the same area or is it a bit...
You want to find out? Yeah, come. I'll show you guys something. You haven't done assessments yet. But we'll do you have any pelvic problems? Anybody here have any issues? Okay, we'll do you in a second. Come, no, come. Okay. You're going to have to lift your shirt up. And good. All right, so we're just going to leave you here. All right, so first off, can you see the dimples? Here and here, correct? Okay, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to be on the... on the iliac crest, I'm going to come back down. Area. Oh, jeez Louise. There we go. I'm going to come off the crests and down towards where the dimples are. Now, what I want to feel here, best way I always put it, is you want to find like a frozen pea. Feels like a tiny little frozen pea, right? So, first off, what do you see? Right high, left low, right? So there's an imbalance here already, just by sheer touch. Now what I'm going to ask you to do is just slowly flex forward until I tell you to stop. Stop. What do you see now? Yeah, this one's moving. This one isn't. Continue down. See it? And good, come on back up. Good. So it's one of the first assessments you'll do is if someone's got some low back issues, right, you want to see, is that SI joint functionally moving properly? And you can see his right one was doing what it's supposed to do, and the left one's jammed. Okay? So there's something going on there that's causing that. There's lots of techniques you can use to open that up. I can tell you, and I am recording, I'm willing to say this, if you had come to me and we'd work together and it's still not moving, that's something I always refer to for a chiropractic adjustment, to get that opened and moving as best as possible. That's something that works really well together, is soft tissue work from us and adjustments from a chiropractor will get that SI joint moving. Do you ever get to a point where you just move the wrong way and you kind of feel jammy and you can't tie your shoes up sometimes on the one side? Yeah, okay. Okay, well, you're like, you may feel that way, but it's actually the opposite, right? So that's your first example of, again, when I'm talking about the intimate nature of the sacrum to the ilium within the context of, shifting and moving properly, you're seeing right off the top. Even standing, he was out, right? So next time you're in lab, just give that a try. When you palpate it, try to do both sides at the same time and see they should be in a straight line across from each other, but are they off a little bit in terms of their movement, right? Okay. So we say the PSIS represents the area of the sacroiliac joint. But remember, it's the area. It's not the joint itself, but you can see how it does represent, is the SI joint functionally moving properly or not within that relationship. Just inferior to the PSIS is the PIIS, which is the site for the attachment of the sacrotuberous ligament, which I do believe we finished off with last semester. Right? We did some of those ligaments there. The PSIS is palpable, but the PIIS is not. So we can see here, coming down the back, Here's your posterior superior iliac spine here and your PIIS down below within it. So when we look here at the picture, here's our two frozen peas, and you can see how they represent the sacroiliac joint in terms of the positioning of it. And here is your sacrotuberous ligament here that's going to attach to that PIIS, right, coming off of here. So you can see how it sort of orients there. But again, just take that away, that, you know, it does represent it enough that you can see whether or not it's functioning properly. The tuberosity of the ilium. So it immediately becomes the auricular surface which articulates with the sacrum. So if you remember, the sacrum had this ear-shaped smoothness on the lateral aspects that looked like an ear. And that was known as the auricular surface of the sacrum. If we turn the ilium over, it too has an auricular surface here. It doesn't have these two posts. That's for the plastic. Exactly. Right? Too bad we don't have this. It'd make it a lot more stable. Okay? So it is somewhat mirror-shaped to the one on the sacrum, okay? So we're saying that the tuberosity of the ilium, it becomes the auricular surface which articulates with the sacrum. So here is our iliac tuberosity here with our auricular surface just below it. So when we see here on the model, here is our auricular surface. This is the iliac tubercle here. What do you note about it? This is the tubercle here. What do you note about the tubercle? What's unusual about it compared to everywhere else? It's rough, right? Lots of ligaments and muscles attach here, which affect the surface of this bone, okay? So it has got a lot that attaches to it. Then you can see how just the forces of the muscles pulling on this strong area of it causes this roughness to occur. Okay? So again, it's these two auricular surfaces that form this sacroiliac joint. The iliac fossa, right, is on the medial aspect here, and it's the large smooth area on the medial surface of the ilium. And it is found at the superomedial aspect. So we've got the iliac tuberosity, we've got the auricular surface here, and then we have the fossa that sits within here. And we're going to find there's a muscle that sits in here called iliacus, right? Hence the reason why collectively that muscle is called iliopsoas. Iliacus and psoas come together to form into a single attachment distally on the femur. So we know them collectively as iliopsoas, but the fact is there is an iliacus which sits in the fossa, and then the psoas, which you're going to learn, actually attaches onto the vertebra, the anterior parts of the lumbar vertebra. Okay? By the way, psoas, of course, is your tenderloin, your beef tenderloin, your filet mignon, is actually the psoas of the cow. Yes. The next part of the bone is known as the ischium. So here we've got the green part here. This is the lateral aspect in the medial. This is the ischium, the lower part. It represents the posterior inferior one-third of the hip, and it too supplies two-fifths of the acetabulum. So now between the two-fifths of the acetabulum from the ilium and the two-fifths of the acetabulum from the ischium, what do we have left? One-fifth, which would be represented by which we'll learn the pubis, okay? So, represents posterior one-third of the hip, posterior two-fifths of the acetabulum. It has two parts to it. It has a body and a ramus, okay? So, a ramus is an extension of bone in its truest sense. So, here we can see the superior ischial ramus here, which is where it finds, it connects to the ilium. And then it has the inferior ischial ramus here, which attaches to the pubis anteriorly. And of course, it's this inferior ischial ramus that you're all sitting on right now. Okay? That's the part you're sitting on. And then between the two is what's considered the body in here. So, the first, of course, is the ischial tuberosity. It is covered by the gluteal group of muscles when it's flexed. Have you palpated this structure? Yes. One of those palpations you kind of have to get a little bit of permission for, right? Because you do kind of get up in there, so to speak, when you're... What's that? I mean, this one you're kind of getting that gluteal fold, and then you're going up and in. Okay. Now the thing is, we have to understand is this is a very important structure for muscle attachments, specifically the hamstrings group. And you are going to find you're working in here. If you end up, if you're treating like hockey players, athletes, getting a hamstring strain, a high hamstring strain, you will be working in here, in terms of working on those hamstring attachments onto that area, and which is, of course, is the part where most of them attach to. So it's palpated through the distal part of glute max, superior to the medial portion of the gluteal fold. Hence, the other reason why it's just an area that you need a bit of permission for, because you're not just coming in into the fold. You've got to get to the medial aspect of the fold to get at it. Okay. And there is a bursa here, and it can get irritated just like any other bursa, and you can get a bursitis here, and then you can't even sit down, it just hurts too much. So you can get a bursitis here as well. The ischial spine, so if we look at this area, the spine separates the greater sciatic notch from the lesser sciatic notch. So you've got a large notch here, superiorly, and a small notch down here. In between the two is a bit of a projection, and this is the ischial spine right here. So we have to remember that we've got body, superior ramus, inferior ramus. We have the greater notch and the lesser notch, and we have the ischial spine right here. So you can see it, right? Here's your ischial spine here. Yeah, and you can see it kind of here with its ligament that is attached to it. It separates what's called the greater sciatic notch and the lesser sciatic notch. And when we put ligaments in, they sit like this and they actually create foramen, which we'll get to when we talk about ligaments, and a smaller one here as well. The superior portion of the greater sciatic notch is formed by the ilium. So the upper part here of the greater sciatic notch is the ilium, and then this represents the lower part, and the lesser sciatic notch is represented by the ischium. Okay, this is the ilium, and then down here is the ischium. The lesser and greater sciatic notches help form the lesser and greater sciatic foramen, of which pass through nerves and vessels, big nerves. Sciatic nerve passes through this area, which is a very... It's almost like the diameter of my finger that passes through. Anybody here ever have sciatica? Right, where you can get it pinched and formed. The spine is also an attachment for a muscle called levator ani. What do you think that does? Elevates the external sphincter of the anus. When you go to the bathroom, this muscle actually contracts, which pulls that area of your body in the appropriate position to defecate. Yes, we don't work on this one. Okay. The ramus. The ischial ramus joins with the ramus of the pubis. It forms the ischial pubic ramus. So here is this ischial pubic ramus here. And this in turn forms what's known as the obturator foramen. Now, the obturator foramen, we're going to learn, actually has a membrane that fills it in, right? Now, part of the reason why this is a big hole, this allows this bone to be a bit lighter in function, but strong at the same time. And we're going to learn that muscles do attach onto the membrane that runs within the obturator foramen to find attachment there. They're the obturator muscles. Okay, so the ischial ramus joins with the ramus of the pubis here, and forms the ischial pubic ramus, and this helps form this obturator foramen. The pubis, of course, is the pubic bone. Have you guys palpated this yet in lab? Yes? Okay. It represents the anterior portion of the hip bone, and of course supplies 1/5 of the acetabulum, which is kind of what's left after the other 2/5 of the other two bones. It has 3 parts to it. It has a superior ramus, an inferior ramus, and a body as well. The two bodies, right and left, articulate at the pubic symphysis. So if you think of where the pubic symphysis is, that's where the pubic bodies are. And then extending out from both those are the two rami, superior and inferior. So again, we have the body here. This is the superior ramus and the inferior ramus. And remember that that inferior ramus will articulate with the inferior ramus of the ischium to form the ischiopubic ramus, which then makes the obturator foramen, and along with the superior ramus here. So here we've got, in the sort of in the correct anatomical position, here's your sort of your bit of attachment here into this ischial ilium area here. Then we've got the inferior one here that attaches with the ischial tuberosity, and the two square areas here at the symphysis pubis represent the body of the pubic bone themselves. So what do we find on here? How'd you find finding all these structures on top? You weren't there that class? Okay. You got to get over the intimate nature of palpating this area. Again, you have muscle structures and ligaments that do attach here, and you will have patients who may have abdominal pulls, strains, and you may be working in this area as well. So the pubic crest, first off, is the thickening of the anterosuperior margin of the superior pubic ramus. So let's think about that. Thickening of the anterosuperior margin of the pubic superior pubic ramus, okay? So here we can see in configuration here. So here we've got our symphysis pubis here, right, with our two bodies, okay? They're coming together to form that joint. And then with that pubic crest, it's a thickening here off of this superior ramus. So you can feel a bit of a thickening there. Next is the pubic tubercle. Now, it's more of a bump than a thickening, and it is on the lateral portion of the pubic crest. So the basically what we see here with the tubercle is sort of this bump that's off the crest right here. What's important here, it is the attachment point for the inguinal ligament. So where else did we learn where the inguinal ligament goes? Right, AIIS. So it's running from here to the AIIS, right? So from here to the AIIS. The ligament runs across here. So that represents the pubic tubercle. Then there is the pectin pubis. Did you palpate this? Did you palpate all these? Okay. You just did the crest probably, right? You did the tubercle as well? Okay. The pectin pubis is a sharp ridge, and it curves posterior laterally on the superior ramus. So the pectin pubis, I don't know if I have it on any of these. There we go. It's this ridge right here in blue. Right? So even if you do it on yourself at some point, right, find those structures and then come out onto them, and that crest that runs off of the bodies represents the pectin pubis. It is the site of the attachment for a ligament that's an extension of the inguinal ligament. That's the reason why the importance of it, because of that. The last one is the iliopubic eminence, and this comes from the pubic tubercle to the pubic eminence. The pubic tubercle to the pubic eminence. So we can see here we've got the tubercle here. It's just an area within this line. So you've got your pubic crest, pectin pubis. Oh, that's for the linear terminalis. Never mind that. Okay, so here's your tubercle and your crest, and then you've got, of course, you've got this iliopubic eminence. You've got ilio, we're talking in sort of this area here. Now, on the ilium, on the lateral aspect, because of muscle attachments here, we have lines. So when we see on the lateral aspect of this ilium, we can see there are lines here. So here's your posterior line, anterior line, and inferior line. And I don't know if these models have them very well. You kind of see them. I don't know if your models have them too well, but sort of picture where they are. Here's your posterior line, your anterior line, and your inferior line. Those are kind of lines on your models like that. Kind of, sort of. Not particularly. They're kind of there, but they're not. So we can see here before I go through the lines. We can see we have three gluteal muscles, not just one. So obviously the major mass of your rear end is gluteus maximus, hence its name. It's in the gluteal region and it's very, very large, and we can see it here. It represents a large portion of this area. When we remove glute max, which we can see it's been removed here, we can see that we have two other muscles. We have a middle-sized muscle and a small muscle. So we have a gluteus maximus, the biggest one, a gluteus medius, which is slightly smaller, and a gluteus minimus, which is the smallest. So maximus covers them all, and then we have medius here at the top, and then minimus underneath that. They all find attachments in the areas on these surfaces of this lateral aspect of the ilium. So there are three pelvic lines, an anterior pelvic line, a posterior pelvic line, and an inferior pelvic line. The posterior pelvic line is where we find the attachment for glute max. So we can see it right here. Here is your posterior line back here. Remember, if we orient ourselves here, this is anterior. Over here is posterior. So glute max attaches right along this posterior gluteal line right here. The anterior gluteal line is a rise on the anterior portion of this external ilia. And the inferior line is found superior to the acetabulum. So again, we can see the anterior line is here running through the middle of the ala. And then we've got the inferior line here just superior to the acetabulum. Gluteus medius attaches between the anterior gluteal line and the posterior gluteal line. And gluteus minimus attaches between the anterior gluteal line and the inferior gluteal line. So again, when we look on here, here's your posterior line here for glute max, right? And then we say med is between AGL and PGL, so anterior and posterior line is back here. And then minimus is between the anterior and the inferior right here. Fundamentally, what you want is that they're all somewhat triangular muscles. Glute max comes all the way around from this posterior line to the femur on this aspect. And then you can see that med and min basically find attachment the same on the upper part of the greater trochanter. And they almost follow the exact sort of triangular configuration down. This is the reason why the artist has removed med here, so that you can see access to glute medius, minimus, underneath. So again, triangular coming down towards the upper part of the femur here at the trochanter, kind of coming in like so. Have you guys done any work in this? You did a bit of gluteal work, right? And you can palpate max, no problem. Kind of difficult to palpate med versus min because they both, the fibers are so much the same in terms of their direction. Now, when we look at the pelvis, there are true and false pelvises. The true pelvis is the area that holds all the reproductive organs, right? So the uterus, fallopian tube, so forth in females, and the prostate in males. And the false pelvis holds all the reproductive organs and the lower abdominal viscera, so a little bit higher, right? So your true pelvis here is in blue, so that's deep down into the bowl. And your false pelvis is in pink here. It's the upper part of the association. Again, still holds some internal sexual organs, but does hold those lower viscera of the abdominal cavity. So again, the pink here is the false pelvis, and blue represents the true pelvis. So how do we orient it? Because when we get the impression when we look at the pelvis, it's like a bowl that sits up, like a salad bowl, and everything sits in it. In fact, it does not. It actually is tilted immensely more than you realize, like so. So you can see here with this frontal or coronal plane, if it's set up appropriately on that line, the anterior superior iliac spines and the pubic tubercles on the pubic bone should actually be in the same line. So if we take this bone, And we think of that, so we think of the pubic tubercles and the ASIS, all right? So it's not sitting this way, because there's your pubic tubercle and your ASIS. It actually sits like this, which is probably not what you ever would have thought it would sit like. So it's up like that. That's how the pelvis sits. So your anterior superior iliac spine is like that. It's down, so it's straight line. So take a moment, stand up, grab a partner, try to find that area of the pubic tubercles and that ASIS to get a sense of where this pelvis is. It actually is forward, sitting straight up and down. What's that? Yes. You're almost tilted anteriorly, right? Yeah. So you need to get those back. But the other problem is, in this position, you're also shortening your psoas. So your hip flexors are really tight and sore. I'm sure when you do lunges and that, they hurt like a bastard, right? When you're doing yoga. No, I mean like the yoga lunge. So like literally that, this. Oh, are you? Okay. So what I want you to see, I want you to get a sense of, here's your ASIS, and try to get a sense of where that pubic tubercle is, and understand that the pelvis is like this, not like that. So it's actually forward, right? So even though we call it a bowl, it's not like a bowl. Take the bowl and it's like that, right? In other words, the concavity of the basin of the pelvis faces anteriorly, not superiorly. Yes, no, maybe. Okay. So, part of what you're going to be doing as well in assessments, we'll digress here a bit. So, appropriately. So, we've got this relationship, like so. And you can see how, when we put the two together, and I put the pelvis in the appropriate position, now you know why you have a lumbar lordosis. Because it's got to get back up to straight again, right? If that was straight ahead, the lumbar spine would be facing towards your belly button, wouldn't it? So because it's in this orientation here, then that you can see how that lumbar spine needs to have that lordosis to come back into position again. If that pelvis is rotated one way or the other, because, as I said, the sacrum is the foundation for the spine, the sacrum, because of its strong attachment to the ilium, it's going to move with it, and what's going to happen to the spine? It's going to react accordingly, right? So if we have anterior rotation, we're going to get hyperlordosis. If we get posterior rotation, we're going to get hypolordosis, or straight back. So if that bum's sticking out and that pelvis is down, we call that sway back, because it could be soft tissue structures such as your hip flexors. If they're tight, they're going to pull the pelvis this way, which is going to result, because if you're this way, if the psoas is pulling down, your hip flexors are pulling down accordingly, well, you're not going to walk around like this all day. Your spine wants to get your head back up again, so the spine increases that lordotic curve to get you up to where you need to be, right? So you see people. I thought it was a bit of a party trick. I remember one girl at a bar, and she came, and it was obvious that she had tight hip flexors, and I said, "You're a gymnast, and you have really tight hip flexors, don't you?" She almost dropped the tray of beer. She's like, "You're a magician." I'm like, no, it was obvious to me. You could see it. She was so tilted. So people who have like any kind of sport that is excessive ranges of motion, like dancing and gymnastics and so forth, if you don't maintain it, those hip flexors will tighten. The other thing is, because you sit all day, unfortunately you have to here, but because you sit a lot, what's going to happen to hip flexors? Because you're stuck in flexion all the time, so they're going to shorten and they become a problem. So you're doing lunges for your glutes, but your lunges are really good for those hip flexors. And what's the position in yoga? I'm kind of done yoga a couple times. Where you're in the lunge and you take your hands and you come back like this. Is that warrior one? Okay. So that one is awesome for hip flexors. Okay. Yeah, I dated a yoga instructor, so I had to do yoga. Are you? Yep. It's hard. It's not easy, man. It's but that will do it. So you can see that's what I mean when we start looking at these, that we do have to consider that association. So the ASIS and superior margin of the pubic symphysis are in the same coronal plane if the pelvis is set up appropriately. The tip of the coccyx is on the same level as the superior one half of the pubic bone. And that's the other thing you need to think about is when we look at that proper orientation of the two, if it's done appropriately, then the tip of the coccyx is in the right position to be on the same line as the pubic body. So that's what we're after, okay? Have you talked about nutation, counter-nutation, that kind of stuff in theory class and in lab? And you all went, well, what the hell does that mean?
Yeah.
Right. Now do you understand? Here's the thing. Your pelvis is three-dimensional, and everything you've been learning is two-dimensional. So right now you know that there's an issue if the pelvis is too anterior or too posterior. But guess what? You can also add this or this. So pelvis can be anteriorly tilted in various different ways based upon muscles and ligaments and structures. So you've got to kind of close your eyes and get your mind into, it's like a gyroscope almost. So this whole thing's like a gyroscope. So we can twist and roll and turn to be off center. Okay? So when we look at the difference between the two males and females, in the female, there's more anterior tilt to the female and less anterior tilt in the male because of the generally speaking, the larger mass above. The female pelvis is, the true pelvis is broader and shallower, and in males, it's narrow and deep. This is why, and it always sounds, people think I'm sounding sexist when I say this, but I'm not. I'm talking scientifically and mechanically. This is why generally women cannot run as fast as men. Because of the wider configuration of the pelvis and the relationship to the femur and the associated muscles, the energy that's created when running, such as sprinting, it gets lost because of how much wider and different that relationship is mechanically. If you look, and the Olympics are coming this summer, when the field competitions begin, look at the pelvises of the female sprinters. And what will you see? A more male narrowness. You won't see a wide pelvic in a female who's trying to be a sprinter. You just lose too much energy created. It's just mechanics. It's just mechanics. So have a look this summer. Look at the female sprinters, and you're all going to forget about it until you click it on and go, oh, yeah, Brian said, look at that. They've got narrow pelvises. And they do. They have very, very narrow pelvises. The pubic angle, so the pubic angle I didn't talk a whole lot about, but when we see here, this is, oops, what did I do here? This is the pubic angle, okay? So it's from the pubic, the area of the body of the pubis and the joint, the symphysis pubis, out to the ischia. So you can see they got an angle here, and you can see it's narrower here. So wider here, narrower here. So we're saying that pubic angle in females is 80 to 90 degrees, and in males it's 50 to 60. Again, why females won't quite run as quickly as males. I'm not saying they can't run as far. They most certainly can. It's just, again, it's mechanics. It's just unfortunate mechanics. The pubic outlet, of course, where baby comes, it is wider and more oval in females because of that of giving birth. It's said to be gynoid. I've got a C there. It shouldn't be there. And then it's narrower in males, more heart-shaped. So this is why you may have wondered from a medical terminology point of view, why are they called a gynecologist? It's because of that. That's where the term comes from. Right? Okay. The acetabula in females is smaller and they're farther apart, And in males, it's larger or greater and closer together. It's just evolutionarily, it sounds really, again, sexist, is not. The women would farm and stay within the area of the social gatherings, and the men would go out in hunter-gatherer associations and hunting, right? We need to run faster and do whatever, because that was just how things worked then. So evolutionarily, we kind of adapted to that. Are there variations on both? Absolutely. It's not written in stone, but this is kind of the average. So you can see here the difference between the two. Now, I can tell you this is, if you are an archaeologist and you were digging up remains, this is one of the things they'll do to define the difference whether the bony remains they're seeing are male or female. So they do the pelvis, they do the jaw. I'm trying to think of what else they do. Something else they do that will help them define what they're looking at. What's that? Yeah, ours are wider and thicker, right? You tend to, you know, the, and I think our mental protuberance is a little bit different as well. So I'm not an archaeologist, but I do know that I know it's the mandible and the pelvis that they'll use to determine the remains, whether they're male or female. Actually, it fascinates me. I watch Digging for Britain is a show on PBS. I don't know if you've ever heard of it. It's a great show. and you'll see these people, these archaeologists, they're digging in the soil, and they pull out this little tiny thing, and they'll say, oh, it's a bone. And she'll say, oh, what is it? Oh, I believe it's the distal head of the fifth metacarpal. And you go, how the hell did you get that from this little tiny piece of bone? But that's why they're experts in that, right? They're able to figure that out. Actually, it's kind of cool. One of the ladies that comes on the show, she's a forensic, she's an osteoforensic I got archaeologist in my head. Thank you, archaeologist. So she, that's her whole specialty was, is she just looks at bones of remains and figures out. And I don't know if you guys know this, now we have new science. We can look at teeth and we know exactly where they came from. So if they had crossed for example, in Britain, if they had crossed the English Channel and they had come from Brittany or Germany or whatever, based upon the kind of foods they ate, it shows up in the teeth and they can look at teeth remains and they could say, oh, this person came from Brittany. Not from England, this came from somewhere else. It's kind of cool. Pelvic joints and ligaments. So, got a lot of weight that gets carried here. We have to transfer. Don't have this one? Yeah. We're going to get into this after break. So, we've got the lumbosacral joints, which we did a little bit of in semester one. The sacrococcygeal joint, we did in one. The sacroiliac joint, we're going to spend a bit more time on it today, and the pubic symphysis, and then the lumbosacral joints. So we're going to talk about the joints within here. I may have to do just a wee bit on the femur to talk about it, but we'll be good. See you guys around between quarter two and 10-2. Okay. So let's go to our joints.
Yay.
So if you remember correctly, last semester we did do a little bit of this. We talked about some ligaments that run between the lumbar spine and the ilium and so forth. So we're going to sort of continue on that. But let's do the sacroiliac joints first. So they are a plain, irregular synovial joint, and this is the articular surfaces of the sacrum and the ilium, remembering those auricular surfaces that relate to each other when we compare the two together. Some feel it's more of a fibrous joint, but there is some synovial in there. It does allow slight gliding and anterior-posterior rotary movements of the ilia. So again, we saw that in the demonstration. You could see that you have this anterior-posterior rotary, which should normally work, so therefore, in flexion, you would see those PSISs travel superiorly because they're rotating around it. Irregular elevations and depressions of the articular surfaces create a sort of a secure fit. We have to remember there's a couple of modifications that occur here. What direction is all the weight going when we're standing? It's an easy question. Down. Okay. So, what shape is your sacrum? Your sacrum is an upside-down triangle, correct? Okay. The two ilium then come in like this, forming some sort of area like so, and you know, forming those sacroiliac joints. So therefore, if gravity is traveling downward, this construction, the way it architecturally is made, you're trying to drive a wedge into a narrow space. So it's providing stability just simply because you have this upside down triangle trying to fit into a narrower space, right? The other thing is, when we look at the surface areas of some of them, you actually see these irregular elevations. You know, remember when we talked about the sutures in the brain, they were like a zipper. Well, this is somewhat similar, but not near as in depth. So just think of small irregular sides that are have corresponding irregularities on the other side, right, within those auricular surfaces. So you get a little bit of undulation and, again, a bit of a fit. So you get this upside-down triangle that's wedging in, and then you get these irregular elevations that help fit it a little bit tighter. So we say irregular elevations and depressions of articular surfaces create a secure fit by partial interlocking. With weight-bearing, the base of the sacrum tends to rotate anteriorly, and, of course, this is counterbalanced by the interlocking articular surface and the sacrotuberous and sacrospinal ligaments. So again, if we think about gravity in relationship to this joint, and we know that it sits like this, you can see how under gravity, the sacrum does want to do that all on its own. Just the weight of the body is going to make it go this way. So that sacrotuberous and that sacrospinous ligaments also act as like a suspension cord, or a, I don't know what you would want to call it, like a support sort of running from here to here that's going to prevent that sacrum from wanting to travel anteriorly and downward, along with this slight interlocking and this wedge that's sitting in. Right? So it does help. It allows it to be much more stable and function better with them. It's much stronger. Makes it much stronger is probably the better way to put it. So we can see here, this is your sacroiliac joints here in a transverse view through an MRI or a CAT scan. It would be more a CAT scan. It's kind of fuzzy. And you can see here is your sacrum here in its configuration. There's the sacral canal. And you can see how we have these spaces in here that represent the sacroiliac joint. And then here's your ligaments here. You can see that our sacrotuberous here, for example, that's preventing that sacrum from wanting to travel downwards and interiorly. Okay? So we're going to get a little more into it a bit later into this sacral joint, but understand that it has a couple of configurations to it. It is partly fibrous and it is partly synovial. The sacrococcygeal joint, that's a symphysis. It's the apex of the sacrum that articulates to the base of the coccyx. And you do have anterior and posterior sacrococcygeal ligaments that correspond with the anterior and posterior longitudinal ligaments kind of running on either side of them. And usually this joint's pretty much ossified with old age. So we can see down, we can see down here that we've got this coccygeal 1 working its way down, and we have the joint occurring here. Remember, we had the cornu there as well. The pubic symphysis is a secondary cartilaginous joint, and that runs between the two superior rami of the two pubic bones, sort of at the bodies. It ends, it's the ends of the pubic bones that are lined with hyaline cartilage, and then we have a fibrocartilaginous disc that lies between those. Same as the discs we see in the spine, right? The symphysis always is the exposed bones have a hyaline layer on them, and then there's a disc in between the two. And it does allow for some movement of the pelvis anteriorly. And, of course, it allows for expansion as well during the birthing process to further enhance the size of that pelvic outlet by having this slightly come apart, not apart, but move away from each other. Hence the reason why, you know, it's considered to be somewhat of a contraindication to do any kind of pelvic joint mobilizations on a woman who's pregnant, because there is excess movement that can occur here. So we can see here, so you've got your two pubic bones here with a layer of hyaline cartilage on it, and then the disc lying in between the two. You're actually, I don't know if it's taught much anymore, but there's a technique I was taught way back when Again, it's with clothes on, not when they're draped on the table, but I can actually mobilize the pelvic bones by getting the patient lying in supine, and I straddle either side of their hips with my knees, and I cross my arms, and I push down on the ASIS's opening. I can actually open that pelvis up a little bit and functionally get it to work. Ligaments. So again, we did this before. We have the iliolumbar ligament, which runs from the iliac crest to the transverse process of L4 or L5, hence its name, iliolumbar. It resists rotation of the L5, that should be L5, I didn't realize I touched the shift button, resists rotation of L5 on the sacrum and also resists forward glide of L5 on the sacrum. There are inferior fibers here from L5 to the lateral part of the sacrum, and these are known as the lateral lumbosacral ligaments. So we can see here in this configuration, we've got the ilium here and our lumbar ligaments here. And we have these iliolumbar ligaments running from the TVP accordingly. We can see it up here as well at the top. Again, running from that L5. In this case, the artist has it at L5, I believe, running from the transverse process out onto the ilia itself. So when we look at the sacroiliac joint, we do have associated ligaments to it. The first is known as the ventral sacroiliac ligament, and this also can be known as the anterior SI ligament. Ventral and anterior are, you need it for both, right? These are thin sheets of fibers, and they pass transversely on an anterior and inferior aspect in relationship to the SI joint. Okay, anterior, inferior. It covers most of the abdominal pelvic surface of the joint, and they can ossify. So we can see here, we've got this big sheet here that's covering anteriorly the SI joint. We can see here's our iliolumbar ligaments here again between the ilium and the TVPs, and then we've got this anterior sacroiliac ligament covering a fair amount of the surface that we see here. Oops, sorry. The next is the dorsal sacroiliac ligament or the posterior SI ligaments. There are two parts to it. There are short, strong transverse fibers, and these they join in the ilium and the first and second tubercles of the lateral crest of the sacrum, and then there are long vertebral fibers that unite the third and fourth tubercles of the sacrum to the PSIS, and these end up blending with the sacrotuberous ligaments. So we can see here the dorsal ones. When looking at the back here, we can see we've got the short posterior sacroiliacs and the long ones here, and it does share some fibers with the sacrotuberous here as it comes down. Fundamentally, when we look at the two of them together, you know, there's so much ligamentous tissue holding all of this together because the amount of forces that are placed under gravity, moving and walking and so forth, you can see them all coming together. So again, short transverse ones which join the first and second tubercles to the sacrum, and long ones that run that unite the third and fourth with the sacrum to the PSIS, which of course would be up in this area here. And you can see sort of the sacrotuberous here and the relationship between the two. Here's your posteriors here. You can see you've got your posterior sacroiliac ligaments deep here, and then you've got these long and short ones here. There's your interosseous ones here, which we talked about last semester, and then your dorsal ligaments here. Next are the interosseous. They're massive, short, strong bundles. They unite the sacral and iliac tuberosities. So where are we at here? Right, we've got the interosseous ones here. So they're these ones in this area. Now imagine the anatomists that have to take this all apart. So they recognize that fibers are slightly different. So again, the interosseous are massively short. They unite the sacral and iliac tuberosities, and they blend with and are supported by the other posterior sacroiliac ligaments. Right, so here's your interosseous ones right in here, and we can see here when we look at, to orient ourselves here, this is our sacrum. We have our two ilium that come here, and what would these two things be right here? These are the PSISs. Okay, so that's how it sits. So you can see that the PSISs are posterior to the actual joint. They represent it because of where they are, but they're not the joint per se. So because we have this flare that comes on either side here, okay, when we're into this narrow area here, we have the interosseous sacroiliac ligaments in this area here filling in, and then we have the posterior sacroiliac ligaments that sit on top of them in that sort of system, okay? So we're saying that the interosseous are very strong, very short, and they unite the sacral and iliac tuberosities. And they're within this area right here. The sacrospinous ligament attaches on the ischial spine. Remember that the ischial spine is what separates the greater and lesser sciatic notches, right? This right here, okay, separating the greater and lesser sciatic notches. So it attaches on the ischial spine and crosses to the anterior sacrum and lateral margin of the sacrum and coccyx. So it travels anteriorly onto the sacrum. It spans the greater sciatic notch. It spans the greater sciatic notch and it converts it to the greater sciatic foramen. So we can see here the sacrotuberous, so sacrospine is here. Where are we here? Right there. There it is, right here. So you can see how it comes to the anterior aspect. Kind of see it tucking underneath here. And this will be your, here's your greater sciatic notch. And then this helps form the greater sciatic foramen. And it runs across here off the spine onto the anterior sacrum. It does help to stabilize the pelvis as well with sacrotuberous. The sacrotuberous, I believe we took last semester, it is a wide attachment. It goes from the sacrum, the coccyx, and PSIS to the ischial tuberosity. Sacrotuberous is here. So we're saying sacrum, coccyx, and PSIS. Sacrum, coccyx, and PSIS. So you can see it has this very large attachment point here, medially, if you want to call it that, out here onto the ischium. Together with the sacrospinous ligament, it converts the lesser sciatic notch into the lesser sciatic foramen. So the sacrospinous helps create the greater sciatic foramen, and the sacrotuberous helps form the lesser sciatic foramen. It assists to prevent body weight from depressing the superior sacrum anteriorly and allows some resilience at the SI joints because it helps transfer the body weight to the hips. Fundamentally, all of this, first and foremost, stabilizes the relationship between the sacrum and the ilia. The second thing it does, the weight that your upper body has is transferred via these ligaments to go into the lower limbs and take all the stress off here. Remember I had you guys sit, do proper posture and had you sit for a long period of time and how uncomfortable you felt it? And I said to you that the reason why you sit poorly is because you put all the stress on the ligaments, therefore you don't feel any discomfort. So you don't even realize that these ligaments are actually functioning and transferring your body weight, but in fact they actually are. The pubic disc, so the pubic symphysis, it is thicker in females. There is an inner cavity which increases during pregnancy in the female. It does allow for some mobility of bones and greater diameter of the pelvic cavity for childbearing. There is a ligament on top of the disc and a ligament at the bottom of the disc. So the superior pubic ligament connects at the pubic tubercles across the top of the disc, and the inferior pubic ligament connects the superior aspects of the joint and forms part of the border of what is known as the pubic arch. So we can see here we have the superior pubic ligament up here and the inferior pubic ligament down here. Okay. Just for a sidebar, if you guys want to know. Oops. Back here a bit. What's going on here? What are you doing right here? So when you see, where is that one picture? Right here. The SI joint, the reason why there's the argument between whether it's synovial or it's fibrous is because of these interosseous sacroiliac ligaments. You see the way the artist has done it here. They've drawn them in to suggest, which many do believe, that this is your synovial part of your sacroiliac joint that has partially fibrous parts to it and partially synovial. So there is synovial membrane and joint space and so on and so forth, with all this fibrous material supporting it. Because although there's movement at this joint, it's minimal at best because we don't want a lot of movement here. So it is considered that the SI joint is partially fibrous and partially synovial. Some people do get inflammation in here, and you can get injections. So the injection goes through the skin of the back, penetrates through all these ligaments, and the needle gets put in. They come from posterior, and they inject the needle into here and then inject the anti-inflammatories in. I go in a week to get it done. And he doesn't freeze me. He just shoves it right in. No, he does it so quickly, and the needle's so small, you get a, and then you don't feel anything. He's surprised. Mine have been 9 months. I've been 9 months since my last one. Remember I told you guys I had a subdural, or I had a epidermal as well? I tell you guys that I had the other problem. So I'm going for both those shots on the 15th. And so, again, I'm active. I work out. I do my stretches every day. I got 9 months out of it, where normally it's maybe month and a half, 2 months for some people. Anyways, just to let you know, it's considered both. Okay, the femur. If you've got one, maybe some of you brought it, maybe some of you didn't. But that's okay. Okay. So, it is the longest and heaviest bone in the body, and it represents a quarter of our complete weight. And of course, as we know, there are two ends, the proximal and distal, for anatomical purposes. And remember, we used this bone when we were talking about osteology in semester one. Remember, we have epiphyses at either ends, and a diaphysis in the center, with the metaphysis in between, and so on and so forth, right? So it is a long bone. We can see it's made up of all these various parts. So at the proximal end, we have the head, the neck, the greater and the lesser trochanter. So again, this greater trochanter, some of us call it the hip point. It's actually what you feel if you rub up at that lateral aspect. You can feel the bony structures just underneath the skin. That represents the greater trochanter. You're looking at the anterior part here. If we spin to the posterior, this is the lesser trochanter. So the greater trochanter is out here superolaterally. Again, we can palpate here. And down here and behind, we have the lesser trochanter. Then we have the head, which is the ball, right? And we can see that just behind the ball, there is a narrowing here. This is considered to be the neck. So we have the head, the neck, the greater, and the lesser trochanters. And you're now looking at the posterior view of the bone. So let's do the head. If we compare to the humerus, where's my humerus? I hate it where things always go missing. I like to believe that students really don't take them. There it is. I do have it. Okay. So, both of these make up a ball and socket joint. The femur, obviously, for the pelvis at the hip, and the proximal humerus at the glenoid fossa of the scapula for the shoulder. What do you notice that's different between the two of them? Okay, the neck's a bit different. Yeah, what else?
The head's like rounder.
Okay, rounder.
It's like more of a ball.
Right, so the head's more of a ball. You still have a convexity to it. Why did this happen? Okay, so yeah, so this one's about stability. And this one's about mobility. So we have 2/3 of a head circle in the shoulder, and we almost have a complete in the hip, right? So when we put it into the acetabulum, this one kind of fits. You can see that it's relatively in there, right? It's in there pretty tight, and it's significantly surrounded. Like, these two don't fit properly. I can tell it could go in a bit deeper if it actually fit better. But you can see that we have a much larger ball that fits into a far deeper concavity in the pelvis. In the shoulder, of course, we had the glenoid fossa, which is very shallow, but the acetabulum in the pelvis is very, very deep and fits accordingly. So we say it's two-thirds of a sphere. It is directed medially, superiorly, and anteriorly. That's important. So when we look at its orientation, we say it's reflected superiorly, which is quite easy. You can see here the angle of the neck. We also say it's medial, but it's anterior. So if we look at it this way, right, from this position, so we have superior, right, we've got it up, and we've got it anteriorly, and then we have it this way. So it actually comes anteriorly to fit in when we look at it in its orientation. So the acetabulum, I guess you could somewhat say, is a little bit anterior to the femur, so the femur has to come a bit anterior to fit in, right? This is what helps it to go into the acetabulum. What's interesting is because of that configuration, they do the exact opposites. So they rotate. If you've ever seen a hip replacement surgery, when the person's asleep and they make their incision, they pop the head out of the acetabulum to remove the head. So a hip replacement is the head is removed at the neck and thrown away. Sometimes the acetabulum is cut out as well if it's in bad shape. They'll screw prosthetic acetabulum into the ilium, and then the head is replaced with a ball that has a long spike on it. When they cut the head off, of course, they want to keep the greater and lesser trochanter intact because all the musculature is attached there. In cutting the head off, they expose the medullary cavity, so the prosthetic ball has a long spike in it, which they hammer down into the medullary cavity of the femur, and then you're good to go. Now, but back in the day, they just used glue or made it fit, and it was okay. They now have chemicals, and the spike has lots of little tiny beads on it that has chemicals in it that promotes bone growth. That actually stimulates osteoblasts to fill in all the spaces around those tiny little beads and anchors it in better, and it lasts a whole lot longer. But yeah, just think of cutting that off and then replacing it with this big ball that's metal and I don't know if it's nylon. It looks like nylon when you look at it. I highly recommend watching some of this stuff. My kids grew up with it. We get the TV tables out, and there was a TV show on PBS called The Operation, and we'd watch an operation while we had dinner every night. Once a week, it was awesome. Yeah, my kids don't get freaked out by any of that stuff. So, medially, superiorly, and anteriorly. The inferior-posterior portion of the head has a pit. Now, unfortunately, in this one where the pit was, it's still somewhat there, but we've got a lot of broken away natural bone here, thus exposing the spongy bone underneath. But there was a pit here. This pit is known as the fovea. I don't know, does anybody have the, is there a little bit of an indentation? Yeah, that's the fovea. And within that fovea, there's a ligament here. And this is known as the ligament of the head of the femur. Duh. Okay. Ligament of the head of the femur. There's also an artery to the head of the femur that goes here and to arise to attach to the head within the hip joint. So within here, we have a big ligament at the fovea, and we have an artery that passes from the acetabulum to the femur. And this artery feeds the proximal epiphysis and the spongy bone there. Now, there's something called avascular necrosis. People can have it and not know it for a very long time, but fundamentally what happens is that artery that feeds the femur, something happens to it, and it can no longer feed the femur. So over time, slowly, the head dies. And we say that it's idiopathic. We don't know why it happens. It can be an injury, so it could be, you know, football players can get it from the impacts and so forth, but quite often we don't know why it happens. It's just that it stops feeding the femur. And what happens is eventually this ball, because it's dead or dying, it collapses, it flattens, because it's no longer a functional bone. So quite often the patient goes into the doctor's office with hip pain, the complaints of hip tightness and hip pain, hard to walk, hard to go for a run, whatever it may be. And of course, quite often they'll say, well, it's this, that, or the other thing, and it takes a bit of time. And then eventually they either get an X-ray or an MRI, and sure enough, the head of the femur somewhat collapsed, and the only repair for this is an artificial hip. Even if you're 30, well, that's what happened to Bo. I was going to say, I was going to use him as an example. You can be in your 30s when it happens. One of my patients, I kind of felt somewhat bad. He came to me for a very long time, and then he ran into some hip problems, and his hips were tight. And I worked with him for the longest period of time trying to get these hips opened up, and he was 40-ish. Todd, about 40. And he finally got someone to do an MRI. He ended up with an artificial hip at 41. It was so much damage. I'd never found out whether or not it was avascular necrosis, but he did have significant changes in the hip that had to be done with a replacement. It was the only option that the patient had in order to be functional again. Well, you still would need it. See,
yeah.
The collapse would still represent as pain in the hip and dysfunction in the hip. So you would notice that it wasn't, the range of motion was down, it wasn't functioning properly. No, it's just, you would, quite often from your perspective and the testing you would do as a therapist, obviously without having tools like MRIs, that kind of stuff, you would think that there was osteoarthritic changes there. So in osteoarthritis or in rheumatoid arthritis in the pelvis, this goes back to, we were talking about open and closed positions here and end feel, that kind of stuff, is extension and external rotation gets lost. Sorry, internal rotation. So what happens is you'll get to internal rotation and you'll hit a bony end feel. It just stops hard. It's a hard end feel. So, and Todd had that. So I did at one point say, look, I think he went to the doctor a number of times. I kept saying, go to the doctor because this bony end feel just isn't good. There's something going on here. And sure enough, he ended up with an artificial hip. You all know your end feels now, right? Yep, do you know them? You can recite them. They're the hardest thing to get to know, because the only way you know them is to feel them. And some of those you may never, ever feel in your entire career, and other ones you will. So when I was at school and they said, oh, a capsular end feel is leathery. Okay. Well, what does that mean? Until you actually feel and go, oh, now I get it. Right? So. So, the head is a ball. Just distal to the head is the neck of the femur. And it connects the head to the body, meaning the diaphysis, at an angle of 125 degrees, which is called the angle of inclination, that results in this L shape. When an artificial hip is put in, before that's done via X-ray or MRI, the angle of inclination is actually considered, because everybody has slight variations, and then the surgeon will have a table of prosthetic heads and then the appropriate angle of inclination. Because if the angle of inclination is wrong in the artificial hip, guess what's going to happen? It's going to wear out faster. Patient's going to express discomfort and or lack of range because it's not fitting right. So, again, if you ever get a chance to watch it being done, you'll see they actually have devices. So it's not just simply they cut this off and drive home that pin and put the head in. They actually have devices that they use that lines it up to be perfect to a normal angle of inclination for that patient so that when that is set in and good to go, it's just like what the one was that was there that they removed. So it does play a big role. This angle starts out straight at birth and increases until the adult angle is reached, about 115 to 140 degrees, depending on the patient. So it's actually like this in a child. And then slowly it does that over time. It is narrow. The neck is narrowest at its middle, and you can see that in this one. And abductors and rotators attach mainly to the apex of the angle, which allows for increased leverage. So this is why you can see that the greater trochanter comes up over top of the neck a little bit. That gives these muscles a mechanical advantage on this. Imagine the strength you have to have when you have, you know, this very large limb and a lot of structure and the weight of the body on top. So your adductors and so forth, they come over the top like this, or your rotators come around like that. Very similar to the shoulder, right? When we think about the shoulder, how you know, your abductors and adductors are all related to those axes of movements and so forth, right? This is exactly the same as the shoulder. So how many axes does it have? Oh, I should be answering that like that. I'm disappointed. How many axes? Three. One, two, three. Same as the shoulder. So again, when we get into the muscles, no different than the shoulder, it's where the muscle is that relates to that axis that results in all the various movements that it does, right? The architecture produces considerable strain on the neck. The neck is frequently fractured in the elderly or postmenopausal women due to decreased minerals. And here's what's unique about that. Grandma doesn't fall down and break her hip. Grandma's neck breaks and then she falls down. So quite often we think that when grandma fell down, that's when she broke the neck. Imagine the strain that's on this neck. And if you have osteoporosis and this gets weak, grandma steps off the curb on the street, goes the neck, and down goes grandma. Okay? And then grandma needs a new hip. So usually it breaks, then you fall, not fall, and then it breaks. What? No, not grandma's neck. And then what they do, unfortunately, good old Canadian healthcare, grandma sits in a bed in the hallway of the emerge department with a weight that's distracting and making sure it's pulled for like a day before she finally goes in and gets her new hip. It's a drive me mad. Because the family's freaking out, she's in discomfort. And they actually... Yeah, the leg is, she's lying down. So what happens when you fracture a pelvis, or sorry, a neck, is that you get the leg shortens and externally rotates. Okay? So what they do is they internally rotate, and then they put a device that wraps around the ankle and put it, then you have a pulley on the bed with a rope, and the rope goes along the pulley with a 10-pound weight, which pulls the femur down to where it somewhat should be. It does relieve a lot of discomfort for the patient, but it's not painless, let's put it that way. Yes, I've seen patients go 2 days and emerge waiting for their surgery. Good old Canadian healthcare. But yeah, just remember, grandma, it breaks and then grandma falls down, not the other way around. There is a broad, rough intertrochanteric line which runs inferior medially from the greater trochanter towards the lesser trochanter anteriorly where the neck and the shaft meet. So, here's anterior and here's posterior. So we're saying there is a broad, rough intertrochanteric line. So we can see the intertrochanteric line is right here, right where the neck meets. So it's in this area right here, okay? Running across from this part here, sort of right here. That's the line right there on the real one, okay? And what attaches here are a couple of muscles. So we say there's a broad, rough intertrochanteric line. It runs afferal medially from the greater trochanter towards the lesser trochanter anteriorly where the neck and the shaft meet, right? So down this way here. The neck, that intertrochanteric line then becomes what's called the spiral line. And it's kind of difficult to see it. I think the pictures probably are a bit better. So we've got the intertrochanteric line running here. And then we can see the spiral line is right here, the pectineal line. So here is the intertrochanteric line running here from anteriorly at the base of the neck from the greater to the lesser trochanter. And it continues on to what's called the spiral line or the pectineal line running posteriorly here to the posterior aspect of the proximal femur. Right? Did I go the wrong way? No. Yeah, I did. Okay. This spiral line becomes the attachment site for a muscle called ilial, or for a ligament, sorry, called the iliofemoral ligament. So obviously from the ilium to the femur. There is also a ridge that joins the trochanters posteriorly, and this is called the intertrochanteric crest. So we've got the intertrochanteric line, which is anterior here, which then becomes the spiral line. Posteriorly, we have the intertrochanteric crest, and you can see how sharp a line that is between the two trochanters, right? So you've got your greater trochanter here, your lesser trochanter here, and then you have this crest that runs right along between, and this would be on the posterior aspect of the femur between the trochanters, running right here. That's that sharp ridge right here. Okay? This is the site for the attachment of quadratus femoris. There's a rounded elevation on the crest, and this is known as the quadrate tubercle. In some texts, this is the only site for the attachment of the quadratus femoris muscle. I don't know about that, but we'll see. Here, so here's your intertrochanteric line here. Here's your trochanteric crest here. And you can see the lesser tubercle here. Here's your pectineal line or your spiral line here. That's coming around from the intertrochanteric line anteriorly. The greater trochanter. It's the largest tubercle in the human body, if you want to use that term. It is a very large projection. Again, just touch up by your lateral hip. Feel that bony structure. That's your greater trochanter. I'm sure you guys have already palpated this many times over. It is found between the neck and the body. It projects superiorly and posteriorly. In the posterior view, the medial surface of the greater trochanter presents a deep depression known as the trochanteric fossa. So this big, deep hole right there is the trochanteric fossa. I don't think you guys have one. It looks like your trochanter is just kind of a blob. Sort of, kind of. Okay, you can see it here. See how it goes deeply in there? That's the trochanteric fossa. Okay? Yeah, you kind of have it there. It's kind of there. So it's that big hole right in there where my finger is. Okay? Right there. In here? Kind of have it. Yeah. Okay. The greater trochanter, reason why it's so large, is because it's the home for three huge muscles. Glute min, glute med, and vastus lateralis. So a lot of strain put on this greater trochanter, hence its size. Glute med, glute min, and vastus lateralis, which is one of the quadriceps. A line joining the tips of the greater trochanter normally pass through the center of the head of the femur and the pubic tubercles. So again, from an orientation point of view, we draw a straight line from the trochanter, goes across the head right to the pubic tubercles. So that's sort of an appropriate anatomical setup in the relationship between the three of them, how things set up. So we can see here, here's your greater trochanter that we can see here. Here is your fossa that's in here. And you can see glute med is here, attaching on the tip. Piriformis is another muscle that attaches here. Glute med, glute min on it. Like, there's a lot of stuff that attaches here, hence the reason its size, because it has a lot of stress placed on it. The lesser trochanter, it projects from the posterior medial surface of the inferior end of the intertrochanteric crest. So again, here's the here's the crest, and the lesser trochanter is on the inferior portion of it. Here, it is the distal attachment for the most powerful hip flexor, iliopsoas. So this muscle goes from your lumbar spine all the way down in front of the pelvic bone to come down here onto the lesser trochanter. From the lesser trochanter to the medial lip of something called linea aspera, we find the pectineal line. So you're going to see here, can you see how a line comes down and then splits in two, right? This is linea aspera here. And we're saying that it goes onto the pectineal line. So if we come to here, remember the pectineal line is the spiral line. So here is linea aspera that we see here, and the pectineal line is coming around. So remember, we had the intertrochanteric line that comes around and becomes the pectineal or the spiral line and comes down onto linea aspera here. So we've got this whole rounded from anterior to posterior coming around and down. Okay? Anterior around to posterior and then down onto the linea aspera. And the pectineal line is the attachment for a muscle called pectineus. The body, of course, we know that is the diaphysis. It is slightly bowed anteriorly. And you may not have realized that. I don't know if the plastic model does that, but you'll see that it bows anteriorly. You can see the bow. Okay, slightly anteriorly. On the posterior aspect is a broad, rough line called the linea aspera, running down through here. And at the middle third of the femur, the linea aspera widens into a lateral and medial lip. So you can actually see here how it just divides into, separates into medial and lateral. Again, I don't know what the plastic one has. Nothing. Okay, you can see it kind of splitting out here. All right? Again, it makes sense how you know these, that something attaches here, right? Hence the reason why they're here. Okay? Superiorly, the lateral lip blends with the gluteal tuberosity, which is the proximal attachment for vastus lateralis. Superiorly, the medial lip blends with the spiral line. And inferiorly, the medial and lateral lips blend with the medial and lateral supracondylar lines. So now we have intertrochanteric, spiral or pectineal, linea aspera, which separates into right and left linea aspera, to then continue on into the right and left, or medial and lateral, sorry, I should say right and left, medial and lateral supracondylar lines or ridges. Okay? So the posterior aspect of the femur has some quite a few lines and ridges on it. So we can see here, here's your intertrochanteric line here. Coming around, here's your spiral or pectineal line, which comes down on then onto the linea aspera, which divides into right or left a bit. And then we have the medial and lateral. Why do I keep saying right and left? I don't know why I keep saying that. Medial and lateral, and then it separates into the medial and lateral supracondylar lines, which run on either side here as we head down towards the distal epiphyses. Distal femur, of course, we have these two huge knuckles on here, the medial and lateral condyles, right on the distal epiphysis. They project posteriorly, so you can see how they actually travel posteriorly back from anterior to posterior, coming back this way. And they are separated by a very deep notch, known as the intercondylar notch. So you can see it's fairly deepened through here, separating both the medial and lateral condyles. Each condyle is separated at the patellar surface by a slight groove called the patellar surface. So this is the patella. And you can see that there is a rough anterior surface and a smooth posterior surface. And you can see that it's somewhat V-shaped, yes? Right. So we've got a rough anterior, smooth posterior, kind of in that V shape. All right, guess where it fits? Right between the two condyles. So this configuration allows the patella to travel around when we're going into flexion and extension. Okay, it fits quite nicely, it fits in. So we say, each condyle is separated at the patellar surface by a slight groove called the patellar surface, which of course the patella fits in. The surface allows the posterior surface of the patella to slide during flexion and extension. Okay? On either side of the condyles are the medial and lateral epicondyles. So the condyles are the knuckles, And then the epicondyles are on either side here, lateral and medial. They serve as attachments for the tibial collateral ligaments and the fibular collateral ligaments, which is lateral. The superior surface of the medial epicondyle has another prominence known as the adductor tubercle. Have you guys done this yet in lab? Okay. It's a big, big muscle called adductor magnus. It attaches, and you can slightly see just the knob right there where my finger is. And that's where this muscle comes down and attaches immediately on here. And you kind of have it on there. So that bump right there is the adductor tubercle, and it is a palpation you will be doing in lab. You can palp this. What's it? Next week you're doing it? Okay. So it's right here on this medial epicondylar area. Right on there you'll see just there's a bit of a bump right there on it. And this is for adductor magnus, the biggest of the adductors. You can see that's right here. The adductor tubercle is right here. Here's your two epicondyles, and then your medial lateral condyles, and there's your patellar surface that we can see here. Do you want me to keep going? Is the last slide? Well, we'll get her done. So, this little guy, your patella, also known as a kneecap, it is considered to be a large sesamoid bone. Okay? It's formed, it's within the tendon of the quadriceps group. So this doesn't stand alone and have muscles attached on either side of it. This is actually embedded in the quadriceps tendon, completely surrounded by it, except, of course, for the articular part that articulates with the condyles. It's located anterior to the midcondylar region of the distal femur. And, of course, as we said, it articulates with the patellar surface of the distal femur. The anterior surface is convex. You can see the anterior surface is convex. The superior base is thick and slopes inferolaterally. So the tip here, the V, is the inferior, and the thick base is superior. So we're saying that the anterior surface is convex and the superior base is thick. So you can see how thick it is as compared to the inferior part. It's actually quite thick as it sits within there. And the lateral and medial borders converge inferiorly to form the pointed apex, which is inferiorly here at this tip part. So the thick base is superior, and the pointed inferior part is considered the apex. This is the base. This is the apex. All right? Which is inferior. The posterior surface is the articular surface. It is very smooth, and in normal circumstances, it's covered in hyaline. Because it is a synovial joint. So you can see the smooth surfaces are still here, but of course, being that this is a human being at one point, that our hyaline cartilage is long since decomposed and disappeared, but it does leave us with the smooth surface on the posterior aspect of the patella where it would articulate on the patellar surface of the distal femur. It's divided into a narrow medial and wider lateral articular surface, with the division being this vertical ridge that fits within this groove of the distal condyles, the separation between the two. So you have that nice V configuration where the patella fits. The ridge and the quadriceps muscle ensure the patella remains centered in the intracondylar groove, and this allows for some mechanical advantage at 90 degrees. So when we're at 90 degrees of flexion, this acts as a bit of a pulley, which can allow the lower leg to come into extension and makes it a little bit easier on the quadriceps to bring it up. You can still extend and flex without one. I have a friend who lost hers. It was a fracture in an accident. It literally, the fracture was so bad, it basically turned her patella to mush, and they had to remove it. So she didn't have one, but she was still able to flex and extend, but it's just easier when the patella is here. It just adds a mechanical advantage. Whoops, there is anybody here had osteomalacia? Ladies in particular, with all the sports. No osteomalacia? Well, I'm surprised. Because of the wider hips in the female, because the muscles are having to come from wider at the pelvis to narrower at the knee, there's a little more lateral pull on the patella in females as there is in males. Make sense? Just mechanically? So it's not unusual for females to get this osteomalacia because the patella is chronically being pulled laterally as it's going up and down the groove, and the reaction is, and I saw this a couple times in the cadaver lab we used to go to, the posterior surface of the patella of the specimen, it was actually like pudding where the bone should have been. It was actually softened to that degree due to it. It's also the reason why anybody here got a dislocated patella, ladies specifically. Because of that pull, women are susceptible to subluxing their patella, having it pop out laterally. It's not uncommon. See a lot in soccer players, rugby players, that can happen, just kind of pops out. Okay? All right, was that the last slide? See y'all. What's that?